park. I tried to imagine him in a parka and grubby clothes with a notepad in the snow, and failed. After that, the first references to blood appeared. While the vampire was with the wolves in Norway, he'd started analyzing their blood to determine family groups and inheritance patterns. Claremont had isolated 4 clans among the Norwegian wolves, 3 of which were indigenous. The 4th he traced back to a wolf that had arrived in Norway from Sweden or Finland. There was, he concluded, a surprising amount of mating across packs, leading to an exchange of genetic material that influenced species evolution. Now he was tracing inherited traits among other animal species as well as in humans. Many of his most recent publications were technical, methods for staining tissue samples and processes for handling particularly old and fragile DNA. I grabbed a fistful of my hair and held tight, hoping the pressure would increase blood circulation and get my tired synapses firing again. This made no sense. No scientist could produce this much work in so many different subdisciplines. Acquiring the skills alone would take more than a lifetime. A human lifetime, that is. A vampire might well pull it off if he had been working on problems like this over the span of decades. Just how old was Matthew Claremont behind that 30-something face? I got up and made a fresh cup of tea. With the mug steaming in one hand, I rooted through my bag until I found my mobile and punched in a number with my thumb. One of the best things about scientists was that they always had their phones. They answered them on the second ring, too. Christopher Roberts? Chris, it's Diana Bishop. Diana! Chris's voice was warm, and there was music blaring in the background. I heard you won another prize for your book. Congratulations. Thanks, I said, shifting in my seat. It was quite unexpected. Not to me. Speaking of which, how's the research going? Have you finished writing your keynote? Nowhere near, I said. That's what I should be doing, not tracking down vampires on the internet. Listen, I'm sorry to bother you in the lab. Do you have a minute?
Sure.
He shouted for someone to turn down the noise. It remained at the same volume. Hold on. There were muffled sounds, then quiet.
That's better, he said sheepishly. The new kids are pretty high energy at the beginning of the semester.
Grad students are always high energy, Chris. I felt a tiny pang at missing the rush of new classes and new students.
You know it. But what about you? What do you need?
Chris and I had taken up our faculty positions at Yale in the same year, and he wasn't supposed to get tenure either. He'd beaten me to it by a year, picking up a MacArthur Fellowship along the way for his brilliant work as a molecular biologist. He didn't behave like an aloof genius when I cold-called him to ask why an alchemist might describe 2 substances heated in an alembic as growing branches like a tree. Nobody else in the chemistry department had been interested in helping me, but Chris sent 2 PhD students to get the materials necessary to recreate the experiment, then insisted I come straight to the lab. We'd watched through the walls of a glass beaker while a lump of gray sludge underwent a glorious evolution into a red tree with hundreds of branches. We've been friends ever since. I took a deep breath. I met someone the other day.
Chris whooped. He'd been introducing me to men he'd met at the gym for years.
There's no romance, I said hastily. He's a scientist.
A gorgeous scientist is exactly what you need. You need a challenge. And a life.
Look who's talking.
What time did you leave the lab yesterday? Besides, there's already 1 gorgeous scientist in my life, I teased. No changing the subject.
Oxford is such a small town. I'm bound to keep running into him. And he seems to be a big deal around here.
Not strictly true, I thought, crossing my fingers, but close enough.
I've looked up his work and can understand some of it, but I must be missing something because it doesn't seem to fit together.
Tell me he's not an astrophysicist, Chris said. You know I'm weak on physics.
You're supposed to be a genius.
I am, he said promptly, but my genius doesn't extend to card games or physics. Name, please.
Chris tried to be patient, but no one's brain moved fast enough for him.
Matthew Claremont. His name caught in the back of my throat, just as the scent of cloves had the night before. Chris whistled. The elusive, reclusive Professor Claremont. Gooseflesh rose on my arms. What did you do, put him under a spell with those eyes of yours? Since Chris didn't know I was a witch, his use of the word spell was entirely accidental. He admires my work on Boyle.
Right, Chris scoffed. You turned those crazy blue and gold starbursts on him and he was thinking about Boyle's law? He's a scientist, Diana, not a monk. And he is a big deal, incidentally.
Really? I said faintly.
Really? He was a phenom, just like you, and started publishing while he was still a grad student. Good stuff, not crap. Work you'd be happy to have your name on if you managed to produce it over the course of a career.
I scanned my notes, stretched out on a yellow legal pad. This was his study of neural mechanisms and the prefrontal cortex?
You've done your homework, he said approvingly. I didn't follow much of Claremont's early work. His chemistry is what interests me. But his publications on wolves caused a lot of excitement.
How come?
He had amazing instincts. Why the wolves picked certain places to live, how they formed social groups, how they mated. It was almost like he was a wolf, too.
Maybe he is. I tried to keep my voice light, but something bitter and envious bloomed in my mouth, and it came out harshly instead. Matthew Claremont didn't have a problem using his preternatural abilities and thirst for blood to advance his career. If the vampire had been making the decisions about Ashmole 782 on Friday night, he would have touched the manuscript's illustrations, I was sure of it.
It would have been easier to explain the quality of his work if he were a wolf, Chris said patiently, ignoring my tone. Since he isn't, you just have to admit he's very good. He was elected to the Royal Society on the basis of it, after they published his findings. People were calling him the next Attenborough. After that, he dropped out of sight for a while.
I'll bet he did. Then he popped up again, doing evolution and chemistry?
Yeah, but his interest in evolution was a natural progression from the wolves.
So what is it about his chemistry that interests you? Chris's voice got tentative.
Well, he's behaving like a scientist does when he's discovered something big.
I don't understand.
I frowned. We get jumpy and weird. We hide in our labs and don't go to conferences for fear we might say something and help someone else have a breakthrough.
You behave like wolves.
I now knew a great deal about wolves. The possessive, guarded behaviors Chris described fit the Norwegian wolf nicely. Exactly. Chris laughed. He hasn't bitten anyone or been caught howling at the moon.
Not that I'm aware of, I murmured. Has Claremont always been so reclusive?
I'm the wrong person to ask, Chris admitted.
He does have a medical degree and must have seen patients, although he never had any reputation as a clinician.
And the wolves liked him. But he hasn't been at any of the obvious conferences in the past 3 years.
He paused. Wait a minute, though. There was something a few years back.
What?
He gave a paper. I can't remember the particulars, and a woman asked him a question. It was a smart question, but he was dismissive. She was persistent. He got irritated and then mad. A friend who was there said he'd never seen anybody go from courteous to furious so fast.
I was already typing, trying to find information about the controversy.
Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, huh? There's no sign of the ruckus online.
I'm not surprised. Chemists don't air their dirty laundry in public. It hurts us all at grant time. We don't want the bureaucrats thinking we're high-strung megalomaniacs. We leave that to the physicists.
Does Claremont get grants?
Oh, yes. He's funded up to his eyeballs. Don't you worry about Professor Claremont's career. He may have a reputation for being contemptuous of women, but it hasn't dried up the money. His work is too good for that.
Have you ever met him? I asked, hoping to get Chris's judgment of Claremont's character.
No. You probably couldn't find more than a dozen people who could claim they had. He doesn't teach. There are lots of stories, though. He doesn't like women. He's an intellectual snob. He doesn't answer his mail. He doesn't take on research students.
Sounds like you think that's all nonsense.
Not nonsense, Chris said thoughtfully. I'm just not sure it matters, given that he might be the one to unlock the secrets of evolution or cure Parkinson's disease.
You make him sound like a cross between Salk and Darwin.
Not a bad analogy, actually.
He's that good.
I thought of Claremont studying the Needham papers with ferocious concentration and suspected he was better than good.
Yes, Chris dropped his voice. If I were a betting man, I'd put down $100 that he'll win a Nobel before he dies.
Chris was a genius, but he didn't know that Matthew Claremont was a vampire. There would be no Nobel. The vampire would see to that, to preserve his anonymity. Nobel Prize winners have their photos taken.
It's a bet, I said with a laugh.
You should start saving up, Diana, because you're going to lose this one, Chris chuckled.
He'd lost our last wager. I'd bet him $50 that he'd be tenured before I was. His money was stuck inside the same frame that held his picture, taken the morning the MacArthur Foundation had called. In it, Chris was dragging his hands over his tight black curls, a sheepish smile lighting his dark face. His tenure had followed 9 months later.
Thanks, Chris. You've been a big help, I said sincerely. You should get back to the kids. They've probably blown something up by now.
Yeah, I should check on them. The fire alarms haven't gone off, which is a good sign.
He hesitated.
Fess up, Diana.
You're not worried about saying the wrong thing if you see Matthew Claremont at a cocktail party. This is how you behave when you're working on a research problem. What is it about him that's hooked your imagination?
Sometimes Chris seemed to suspect I was different, but there was no way to tell him the truth.
I have a weakness for smart men.
He sighed.
Okay, don't tell me. You're a terrible liar, you know. But be careful. If he breaks your heart, I'll have to kick his ass, and this is a busy semester for me.
Matthew Claremont isn't going to break my heart, I insisted. He's a colleague, one with broad reading interests, that's all.
For someone so smart, you really are clueless. I bet you $10 he asks you out before the week is over.
I laughed.
Are you ever going to learn?
$10, then, or the equivalent in British sterling, when I win.
We said our goodbyes. I still didn't know much about Matthew Claremont, but I had a better sense of the questions that remained, most important among them being why someone working on a breakthrough in evolution would be interested in 17th century alchemy. I surfed the internet until my eyes were too tired to continue. When the clocks struck midnight, I was surrounded by notes on wolves and genetics, but was no closer to unraveling the mystery of Matthew Claremont's interest in Ashmole 782.
Chapter 6. The next morning was gray, and much more typical of early autumn. All I wanted to do was cocoon myself in layers of sweaters and stay in my rooms. One glance at the heavy weather convinced me not to return to the river. I set out for a run instead, waving at the night porter in the lodge, who gave me an incredulous look, followed by an encouraging thumbs up. With each slap of my feet on the sidewalk, some stiffness left my body. By the time they reached the gravel paths of the university parks, I was breathing deeply and felt relaxed and ready for a long day in the library, no matter how many creatures were gathered there. When I got back, the porter stopped me.
Dr. Bishop?
Yes?
I'm sorry about turning your friend away last night, but it's college policy. Next time you're having guests, let us know and we'll send them straight up.
The clear-headedness from my run evaporated.
Was it a man or a woman? I asked sharply.
A woman.
My shoulders floated down from around my ears.
She seemed perfectly nice and always like Australians. They're friendly without being, you know.
The porter trailed off, but his meaning was clear. Australians were like Americans, but not so pushy.
We did call up to your rooms.
I frowned. I'd switched off the phone's ringer, because Sarah never calculated the time difference between Madison and Oxford correctly and was always calling me in the middle of the night. That explained it.
Thank you for letting me know.
I'll be sure to tell you about any future visitors, I promised. Back in my rooms, I flipped on the bathroom light and saw that the past 2 days had taken a toll. The circles that had appeared under my eyes yesterday had now blossomed into something resembling bruises. I checked my arm for bruises, too, and was surprised not to find any. The vampire's grip had been so strong that I was sure Claremont had broken the blood vessels under the skin. I showered and dressed in loose trousers and a turtleneck. Their unalleviated black accentuated my height and minimized my athletic build, but it also made me resemble a corpse, so I tied a soft periwinkle sweater around my shoulders. That made the circles under my eyes look bluer, but at least I no longer looked dead. My hair threatened to stand straight up from my head and crackled every time I moved. The only solution for it was to scrape it back into a messy knot at the nape of my neck. Claremont's trolley had been stuffed with manuscripts, and I was resigned to seeing him in Duke Humphrey's reading room. I approached the call desk with shoulders squared. Once again, the supervisor and both attendants were flapping around like nervous birds. This time, their activity was focused on the triangle between the call desk, the manuscript card catalogs, and the supervisor's office. They carried stacks of boxes and pushed carts loaded with manuscripts under the watchful eyes of the gargoyles and into the first 3 bays of ancient desks. "Thank you, Sean." Claremont's deep, courteous voice floated from their depths. The good news was that I would no longer have to share a desk with a vampire. The bad news was that I couldn't enter or leave the library, or call a book or manuscript without Claremont's tracking my every move. And today, he had backup. A diminutive girl was stacking up papers and file folders in the second alcove. She was dressed in a long, baggy brown sweater that reached almost to her knees. When she turned, I was startled to see a full-grown adult. Her eyes were amber and black, and as cold as frostbite. Even without their touch, her luminous, pale skin and unnaturally thick, glossy hair gave her away as a vampire. Snaky waves of it undulated around her face and over her shoulders. She took a step toward me, making no effort to disguise the swift, sure movements, and gave me a withering glance. This was clearly not where she wanted to be, and she blamed me. "Miriam," Claremont called softly, walking out into the center aisle. He stopped short, and a polite smile shaped his lips. "Dr. Bishop, good morning." He raked his fingers through his hair, which only made it look more artfully tousled. I patted my own hair self-consciously and tucked a stray strand behind my ear. "Good morning, Professor Claremont. Back again, I see." "Yes, but today I won't be joining you in the Selden End. They've been able to accommodate us here, where we won't disturb anyone." The female vampire rapped a stack of papers sharply against the top of the desk. Claremont smiled. "May I introduce my research colleague, Dr. Miriam Shepherd? Miriam, this is Dr. Diana Bishop."
"Dr. Bishop," Miriam said coolly, extending her hand in my direction. I took it and felt a shock at the contrast between her tiny, cold hand and my own larger, warmer one. I began to draw back, but her grip grew firmer, crushing the bones together. When she finally let go, I had to resist the urge to shake out my hand.
"Dr. Shepherd?"
The three of us stood awkwardly. What were you supposed to ask a vampire first thing in the morning? I fell back on human platitudes.
"I should really get to work."
"Have a productive day," Claremont said,
his nod as cool as Miriam's greeting.
Mr. Johnson appeared at my elbow, my small stack of gray boxes waiting in his arms.
"We've got you an A4 today, Dr. Bishop," he said with a pleased puff of his cheeks. "I'll just carry these back for you."
Claremont's shoulders were so broad that I couldn't see around him to tell if there were bound manuscripts on his desk. I stifled my curiosity and followed the reading room supervisor to my familiar seat in the Selden End. Even without Claremont sitting across from me, I was acutely aware of him as I took out my pencils and turned on my computer. My back to the empty room, I picked up the first box, pulled out the leather-bound manuscript, and placed it in the cradle.
The familiar task of reading and taking notes soon absorbed my attention, and I finished with the first manuscript in less than 2 hours. My watch revealed that it was not yet 11. There was still time for another before lunch. The manuscript inside the next box was smaller than the last, but it contained interesting sketches of alchemical apparatus and snippets of chemical procedures that read like some unholy combination of Joy of Cooking and a poisoner's notebook. "Take your pot of mercury and seethe it over a flame for 3 hours," began one set of instructions, "and when it has joined with the philosophical child, take it and let it putrefy until the black crow carries it away to its death." My fingers flew over the keyboard, picking up momentum as the minutes ticked by. I had prepared myself to be stared at today by every creature imaginable, but when the clocks chimed one, I was still virtually alone in the Selden End. The only other reader was a graduate student wearing a red, white, and blue-striped Keble College scarf. He stared morosely at a stack of rare books without reading them and bit his nails with occasional loud clicks. After filling out 2 new request slips and packing up my manuscripts, I left my seat for lunch, satisfied with the morning's accomplishments. Gillian Chamberlain stared at me malevolently from an uncomfortable-looking seat near the ancient clock as I passed by. The 2 female vampires from yesterday drove icicles into my skin, and the demon from the music reference room had picked up 2 other demons. The 3 of them were dismantling a microfilm reader, the parts scattered all around them and a roll of film unspooling, unnoticed, on the floor at their feet. Claremont and his vampire assistant were still stationed near the reading room's call desk. The vampire claimed that the creatures were flocking to me, not to him. But their behavior today suggested otherwise, I thought with triumph. While I was returning my manuscripts, Matthew Claremont eyed me coldly. It took a considerable effort, but I refrained from acknowledging him. "All done with these?" Sean asked. "Yes, there are still 2 more at my desk. If I could have these as well, that would be great." I handed over the slips. "Do you want to join me for lunch?" "Valerie just stepped out. I'm stuck here for a while, I'm afraid," he said with regret. "Next time." Gripping my wallet, I turned to leave. Claremont's low voice stopped me in my tracks. "Miriam, it's lunchtime." "I'm not hungry," she said in a clear melodic soprano that contained a rumble of anger. "The fresh air will improve your concentration." The note of command in Claremont's voice was indisputable. Miriam sighed loudly, snapped her pencil onto her desk, and emerged from the shadows to follow me. My usual meal consisted of a 20-minute break in the nearby bookstore's second-floor cafe. I smiled at the thought of Miriam occupying herself during that time, trapped in Blackwell's where the tourists congregated to look at postcards, smack between the Oxford guidebooks and the true crime section. I secured a sandwich and some tea and squeezed into the farthest corner of the crowded room between a vaguely familiar member of the history faculty who was reading a paper and an undergraduate dividing his attention between a music player, a mobile phone, and a computer. After finishing my sandwich, I cupped the tea in my hands and glanced out the windows. I frowned. One of the unfamiliar demons from Duke Humphreys was lounging against the library gates and looking up at Blackwell's windows. 2 nudges pressed against my cheekbones, as gentle and fleeting as a kiss. I looked up into the face of another demon. She was beautiful, with arresting, contradictory features, her mouth too wide for her delicate face, her chocolate brown eyes too close together given their enormous size, her hair too fair for skin the color of honey. "Dr. Bishop?" The woman's Australian accent sent cold fingers moving around the base of my spine. "Yes," I whispered, glancing at the stairs. Miriam's dark head failed to emerge from below. "I'm Diana Bishop." She smiled. "I'm Agatha Wilson, and your friend downstairs doesn't know I'm here." It was an incongruously old-fashioned name for someone who was only about 10 years older than I was and far more stylish. Her name was familiar, though, and I dimly remembered seeing it in a fashion magazine. "May I sit down?" she asked, gesturing at the seat just vacated by the historian. "Of course," I murmured.
On Monday, I'd met a vampire. On Tuesday, a witch tried to worm his way into my head. Wednesday, it would appear, was Demon Day.
Even though they'd followed me around college, I knew even less about demons than I did about vampires. Few seemed to understand the creatures, and Sarah had never been able to answer my questions about them. Based on her accounts, demons constituted a criminal underclass. Their superabundance of cleverness and creativity led them to lie, steal, cheat, and even kill because they felt they could get away with it. Even more troublesome, as far as Sarah was concerned, were the conditions of their birth. There was no telling where or when a demon would crop up, since they were typically born to human parents. To my aunt, this only compounded their already marginal position in the hierarchy of beings. She valued a witch's family traditions and bloodlines, and she didn't approve of demonic unpredictability. Agatha Wilson was content to sit next to me quietly at first, watching me hold my tea. Then she started to talk in a bewildering swirl of words. Sarah always said that conversations with demons were impossible because they began in the middle.
"So much energy is bound to attract us," she said matter-of-factly, as if I'd asked her a question. "The witches were in Oxford for Mabon, and chattering as if the world weren't full of vampires who hear everything." She fell silent. "We weren't sure we'd ever see it again."
"See what?" I said softly.
"The book," she confided in a low voice.
"The book," I repeated, my voice flat.
"Yes. After what the witches did to it, we didn't think we'd catch a glimpse of it again." The demon's eyes were focused on a spot in the middle of the room. "Of course you're a witch, too. Perhaps it's wrong to talk to you. I would have thought you, of all witches, would be able to figure out how they did it, though. Now there's this," she said sadly, picking up the abandoned newspaper and handing it to me. The sensational headline immediately caught my attention. "Vampire on the Loose in London." I hurriedly read the story. "Metropolitan police have no new leads in the puzzling murder of two men in Westminster. The bodies of Daniel Bennett, 22, and Jason Enright, 26, were found in an alley behind the White Hart pub on St. Albans Street early Sunday morning by the pub's owner, Reg Scott. Both men had severed carotid arteries and multiple lacerations on the neck, arms, and torso. Forensic tests revealed that massive loss of blood was the cause of death, although no blood evidence was found at the scene. Authorities investigating the vampire murders, as they were dubbed by local residents, sought the advice of Peter Knox, the author of best-selling books on modern occultism, including Dark Matters, The Devil in Modern Times, and Magic Rising, The Need for Mystery in the Age of Science. Knox has been consulted by agencies around the world in cases of suspected satanic and serial killings. "There's no evidence that these are ritual murders," Knox told reporters at a news conference. "Nor does it seem that this is the work of a serial killer," he concluded. "In spite of the similar murders of Christiana Nielsen in Copenhagen last summer, and Sergei Morozov in St. Petersburg in the fall of 2007, when pressed, Knox conceded that the London case may involve a copycat killer or killers. Concerned residents have instituted a public watch, and local police have launched a door-to-door safety campaign to answer questions and provide support and guidance. Officials urge London residents to take extra precautions for their safety, especially at night." "That's just the work of a newspaper editor in search of a story," I said, handing the paper back to the demon. "The press is preying on human fears." "Are they?" she asked, glancing around the room. "I'm not so sure. I think it's much more than that. One never knows with vampires. They're only a step away from animals."
Agatha Wilson's mouth drew tight in a sour expression. "And you think we're the unstable ones. Still, it's dangerous for any of us to catch human attention." This was too much talk of witches and vampires for a public place. The undergraduate still had his earphones in, however, and all the other patrons were deep into their own thoughts or had their heads close to their lunch companions. "I don't know anything about the manuscript or what the witches did to it, Miss Wilson."
"I don't have it either," I said hastily, in case she, too, thought I might have stolen it.
"You must call me Agatha."
She focused on the pattern in the carpet.
The library has it now. Did they tell you to send it back?
Did she mean witches, vampires, the librarians? I picked the likeliest culprits.
Witches? I whispered. Agatha nodded, her eyes drifting around the room. No, when I was done with it, I simply returned it to the stacks.
Ah, the stacks, Agatha said knowingly. Everybody thinks the library is just a building, but it isn't.
Once again, I remembered the eerie constriction I'd felt after Sean had put the manuscript on the conveyor belt.
The library is whatever the witches want it to be, she went on, but the book doesn't belong to you. Witches shouldn't get to decide where it's kept and who sees it.
What's so special about this manuscript?
The book explains why we're here, she said, her voice betraying a hint of desperation. It tells our story, beginning, middle, even the end. We demons need to understand our place in the world. Our need is greater than that of the witches or vampires.
There was nothing addled about her now. She was like a camera that had been chronically out of focus until someone came by and twisted the lenses into alignment. You know your place in the world, I began. There are four kinds of creatures, humans, demons, vampires, and witches.
And where did demons come from? How are we made? Why are we here?
Her brown eyes snapped.
Do you know where your power comes from? Do you?
No, I whispered, shaking my head.
Nobody knows, she said wistfully. Every day we wonder. Humans thought demons were guardian angels at first. Then they believed we were gods, bound to the earth and victims of our own passions. Humans hated us because we were different, and abandoned their children if they turned out to be demons. They accused us of possessing their souls and making them insane. Demons are brilliant, but we're not vicious. Not like vampires.
Her voice was clearly angry now, though it never lifted above a murmur. We would never make someone insane. Even more than witches, we're victims of human fear and envy.
Witches have their share of nasty legends to contend with, I said, thinking of the witch hunts and the executions that followed.
Witches are born to witches. Vampires make other vampires. You have family stories and memories to comfort you when you're lonely or confused. We have nothing but tales told to us by humans. It's no wonder so many demons are broken in spirit. Our only hope lies in brushing against other demons one day and no one will like them. My son was one of the lucky ones. Nathaniel had a demon for a mother, someone who saw the signs and could help him understand.
She looked away for a moment, regaining her composure. When her eyes again met mine, they were sad.
Maybe the humans are right. Maybe we are possessed. I see things, Diana, things I shouldn't.
Demons could be visionaries. No one knew if their visions were reliable, like the visions that witches had.
I see blood and fear. I see you, she said, her eyes losing focus again. Sometimes I see the vampire. He's wanted this book for a very long time. Instead he's found you. Curious.
Why does Matthew Claremont want the book?
Agatha shrugged. Vampires and witches don't share their thoughts with us. Not even your vampire tells us what he knows, though he's fonder of demons than most of his kind.
So many secrets, and so many clever humans these days. They'll figure it out if we're not careful.
Humans like power. Secrets, too.
He's not my vampire, I flushed.
Are you sure?
She asked, staring into the chrome on the espresso machine as if it were a magic mirror. Yes, I said tightly.
A little book can hold a big secret, one that might change the world. You're a witch. You know words have power, and if your vampire knew the secret, he wouldn't need you.
Agatha's brown eyes were now melting and warm.
Matthew Claremont can call the manuscript himself if he wants it so badly. The idea that he might be doing so now was unaccountably chilling.
When you get it back, she said urgently, grabbing my arm, promise me you'll remember that you aren't the only ones who need to know its secrets. Demons are part of the story, too. Promise me. I felt a flicker of panic at her touch, felt suddenly aware of the heat of the room and the press of people in it. Instinctively, I searched for the nearest exit while focusing on my breathing, trying to curb the beginnings of a fight-or-flight response.
I promise, I murmured hesitantly, not sure what it was I was agreeing to. Good, she said absently, dropping my arm. Her eyes drifted away.
It's good of you to speak with me.
Agatha was staring at the carpet once more.
We'll see each other again. Remember, some promises matter more than others.
I dropped my teapot and cup into the gray plastic tub on the top of the trash and threw away the bag from my sandwich. When I glanced over my shoulder, Agatha was reading the sports section of the historian's discarded London Daily. On my way out of Blackwell's, I didn't see Miriam, but I could feel her eyes. The Selden End had filled with ordinary human beings while I was gone, all of them busy with their own work and completely oblivious to the creature convention around them. Envious of their ignorance, I took up a manuscript, determined to concentrate, but instead found myself reviewing my conversation in Blackwell's and the events of the past few days. On an immediate level, the illustrations in Ashmole 782 didn't seem related to what Agatha Wilson had said the book was about. And if Matthew Claremont and the demon were so interested in the manuscript, why didn't they request it? I closed my eyes, recalling the details of my encounter with the manuscript and trying to make some pattern of the events of the past few days by emptying my mind and imagining the problem as a jigsaw puzzle sitting on a white table, then rearranging the colorful shapes. But no matter where they were placed, no clear picture emerged. Frustrated, I pushed my chair away from my desk and walked toward the exit. "Any requests?" Sean asked as he took the manuscripts from my arms. I handed him a bunch of freshly filled out call slips. He smiled at the stack's thickness, but didn't say a word. Before leaving, I needed to do two things. The first was a matter of simple courtesy. I wasn't sure how they'd done it, but the vampires had kept me from being distracted by an endless stream of creatures in the Selden End. Witches and vampires didn't often have an occasion to thank one another, but Claremont had protected me twice in 2 days. I was determined not to be ungrateful or bigoted like Sarah and her friends in the Madison Coven. "Professor Claremont?" The vampire looked up. "Thank you," I said simply, meeting his gaze and holding it until he looked away. "You're welcome," he murmured, a note of surprise in his voice. The second was more calculated. If Matthew Claremont needed me, I needed him too. I wanted him to tell me why Ashmole 782 was attracting so much attention. "Perhaps you should call me Diana," I said quickly, before I lost my nerve. Matthew Claremont smiled. My heart stopped beating for a fraction of a second. This was not the small, polite smile with which I was now familiar. His lips curved toward his eyes, making his whole face sparkle. God, he was beautiful, I thought again, slightly dazzled. "All right," he said softly. "But then you must call me Matthew." I nodded in agreement, my heart still beating in erratic syncopation. Something spread through my body, loosening the vestiges of anxiety that remained after the unexpected meeting with Agatha Wilson. Matthew's nose flared delicately. His smile grew a bit wider. Whatever my body was doing, he had smelled it. What's more, he seemed to have identified it. I flushed. "Have a pleasant evening, Diana." His voice lingered on my name, making it sound exotic and strange. "Good night, Matthew," I replied, beating a hasty retreat. That evening, rowing on the quiet river as sunset turned to dusk, I saw an occasional smoky smudge on the towpath, always slightly ahead of me, like a dark star guiding me home. Chapter 7. At 2:15, I was ripped from sleep by a terrible sensation of drowning. Flailing my way out from under the covers, transformed into heavy, wet seaweed by the power of the dream, I moved toward the lighter water above me. Just when I was making progress, something grabbed me by the ankle and pulled me down deeper. As usual with nightmares, I awoke with a start before finding out who had caught me. For several minutes I lay disoriented, my body drenched with sweat and my heart sounding a staccato beat that reverberated through my ribcage. Gingerly, I sat up. A white face stared at me from the window with dark, hollow eyes. Too late, I realized that it was just my reflection in the glass. I barely made it to the bathroom before being sick. Then I spent the next 30 minutes curled into a ball on the cold tile floor, blaming Matthew Claremont and the other gathering creatures for my unease. Finally, I crawled back into bed and slept for a few hours. At dawn, I dragged myself into rowing gear. When I got to the lodge, the porter gave me an amazed look.
"You're not going out at this hour in the fog, Dr. Bishop. You look like you've been burning the candle at both ends, if you don't mind my saying so. Wouldn't a nice lie-in be a better idea? The river will still be there tomorrow."
After considering Fred's advice, I shook my head. "No, I'll feel better for it." He looked doubtful. "And the students are back this weekend." The pavement was slick with moisture, so I ran more slowly than usual to make allowances for the weather as well as my fatigue. My familiar route took me past Oriel College and to the tall, black iron gates between Merton and Corpus Christi. They were locked from dusk until dawn to keep people out of the meadows that bordered the river, but the first thing you learned when you rode at Oxford was how to scale them. I climbed them with ease. The familiar ritual of putting the boat in the water did its work. By the time it slipped away from the dock and into the fog, I felt almost normal. When it's foggy, rowing feels even more like flying. The air muffles the normal sounds of birds and automobiles and amplifies the soft thwack of oars in the water and the swoosh of the boat seats. With no shorelines and familiar landmarks to orient you, there's nothing to steer by but your instincts. I fell into an easy, swinging rhythm in the scull, my ears and eyes tuned to the slightest change in the sound of my oars that would tell me I was getting too close to the banks, or a shadow that would indicate the approach of another boat. The fog was so thick that I considered turning back, but the prospect of a long, straight stretch of river was too enticing. Just shy of the tavern, I carefully turned the boat. Two rowers were downstream, engaged in a heated discussion about competing strategies for winning the idiosyncratic Oxbridge style of racing known as bumps.
"Do you want to go ahead of me?" I called.
"Sure,"
came the quick response. The pair shot past, never breaking their stroke. The sound of their oars faded. I decided to row back to the boathouse and call it quits. It was a short workout, but the stiffness from my third consecutive night of little sleep had lessened. The equipment put away, I locked the boathouse and walked slowly along the path toward town. It was so quiet in the early morning mist that time and place receded. I closed my eyes, imagining that I was nowhere, not in Oxford, nor anywhere that had a name. When I opened them, a dark outline had risen up in front of me. I gasped in fear. The shape shot toward me, and my hands instinctively warded off the danger.
"Diana, I'm so sorry. I thought you'd seen me."
It was Matthew Claremont, his face creased with concern.
"I was walking with my eyes closed."
I grabbed at the neck of my fleece and he backed away slightly. I propped myself against a tree until my breathing slowed.
"Can you tell me something?" Claremont asked once my heart stopped pounding. "Not if you plan on asking why I'm out on the river in the fog when there are vampires and demons and witches following me."
I wasn't up for a lecture, not this morning.
"No." His voice held a touch of acid. "Although that's an excellent question. I was going to ask why you walk with your eyes closed." I laughed.
"What? You don't?" Matthew shook his head.
"Vampires have only 5 senses. We find it best to use all of them," he said sardonically.
"There's nothing magical about it, Matthew. It's a game I've played since I was a child. It made my aunt crazy. I was always coming home with bruised legs and scratches from running into bushes and trees."
The vampire looked thoughtful. He shoved his hands into his slate-gray trouser pockets and gazed off into the fog. Today he was wearing a blue-gray sweater that made his hair appear darker, but no coat. It was a striking omission, given the weather. Suddenly feeling unkempt, I wished my rowing tights didn't have a hole in the back of the left thigh from catching on the boat's rigging.
"How was your row this morning?" Claremont asked finally, as if he didn't already know. He wasn't out for a morning stroll.
"Good," I said shortly.
"There aren't many people here this early."
"No, but I like it when the river isn't crowded."
"Isn't it risky to row in this kind of weather, when so few people are out?"
His tone was mild, and had he not been a vampire, watching my every move, I might have taken his inquiry for an awkward attempt at conversation.
"Risky how?" "If something were to happen, it's possible nobody would see it."
I'd never been afraid before on the river, but he had a point. Nevertheless, I shrugged it off. "The students will be here on Monday. I'm enjoying the peace while it lasts."
"Does term really start next week?"
Claremont sounded genuinely surprised.
"You are on the faculty, aren't you?"
I laughed.
"Technically, but I don't really see students. I'm here in more of a research capacity."
His mouth tightened. He didn't like being laughed at.
"Must be nice."
I thought of my 300-seat introductory lecture class and all of those anxious freshmen.
"It's quiet. My laboratory equipment doesn't ask questions about my long hours, and I have Dr. Shepherd and another assistant, Dr. Whitmore, so I'm not entirely alone."
It was damp, and I was cold. Besides, there was something unnatural about exchanging pleasantries with a vampire in the pea-soup gloom. I really should go home.
"Would you like a ride?"
4 days ago, I wouldn't have accepted a ride home from a vampire, but this morning it seemed like an excellent idea. Besides, it gave me an opportunity to ask why a biochemist might be interested in a 17th-century alchemical manuscript.
"Sure," I said.
Claremont's shy, pleased look was utterly disarming.
"My car's parked nearby," he said, gesturing in the direction of Christ Church College.
We walked in silence for a few minutes, wrapped up in the gray fog and the strangeness of being alone, witch and vampire. He deliberately shortened his stride to keep in step with me, and he seemed more relaxed outdoors than he had in the library.
"Is this your college?"
"No, I've never been a member here."
The way he phrased it made me wonder what colleges he had been a member of. Then I began to consider how long his life had been. Sometimes he seemed as old as Oxford itself.
"Diana?"
Claremont had stopped.
"Hmm?"
I'd started to wander off toward the college's parking area.
"It's this way," he said, pointing in the opposite direction.
Matthew led me to a tiny walled enclave. A low-slung black Jaguar was parked under a bright yellow sign that proclaimed, "Positively no parking here." The car had a John Radcliffe hospital permit hanging from the rearview mirror.
"I see," I said, putting my hands on my hips. "You park pretty much wherever you want."
"Normally I'm a good citizen when it comes to parking, but this morning's weather suggested that an exception might be made," Matthew said defensively.
He reached a long arm around me to unlock the door. The Jaguar was an older model, without the latest technology of keyless entries and navigation systems, but it looked as if it had just rolled off the showroom floor. He pulled the door open and I climbed in, the caramel-colored leather upholstery fitting itself to my body. I'd never been in a car so luxurious. Sarah's worst suspicions about vampires would be confirmed if she knew they drove Jaguars while she drove a broken-down purple Honda Civic that had oxidized to the brownish lavender of roasted eggplant. Claremont rolled along the drive to the gates of Christ Church, where he waited for an opening in the early morning traffic, dominated by delivery trucks, buses, and bicycles.
"Would you like some breakfast before I take you home?" he asked, casually, gripping the polished steering wheel. "You must be hungry after all that exercise."
This was the second meal Claremont had invited me to not share with him. Was this a vampire thing? Did they like to watch other people eat? The combination of vampires and eating turned my mind to the vampires' dietary habits. Everyone on the planet knew that vampires fed on human blood. But was that all they ate?
No longer sure that driving around in a car with a vampire was a good idea, I zipped up the neck of my fleece pullover and moved an inch closer to the door.
Diana, he prompted.
I could eat, I admitted hesitantly. And I'd kill for some tea.
He nodded, his eyes back on the traffic. I know just the place.
Claremont steered up the hill and took a right down the high street. We passed the statue of George II's wife standing under the cupola at the Queen's College, then headed toward Oxford's Botanical Gardens. The hushed confines of the car made Oxford seem even more otherworldly than usual, its spires and towers appearing suddenly out of the quiet and fog. We didn't talk, and his stillness made me realize how much I moved, constantly blinking, breathing, and rearranging myself. Not Claremont. He never blinked and seldom breathed, and his every turn of the steering wheel or push of the pedals was as small and efficient as possible, as if his long life required him to conserve energy. I wondered again how old Matthew Claremont was. The vampire darted down a side street, pulling up in front of a tiny cafe that was packed with locals bolting down plates of food. Some were reading the newspaper, others were chatting with their neighbors at adjoining tables. All of them, I noted with pleasure, were drinking huge mugs of tea. I didn't know about this place, I said.
It's a well-kept secret, he said mischievously. They don't want university dons ruining the atmosphere.
I automatically turned to open my car door, but before I could touch the handle, Claremont was there, opening it for me.
How did you get here so fast? I grumbled.
Magic, he replied through pursed lips. Apparently, Claremont didn't approve of women who opened their own car doors any more than he reportedly approved of women who argued with him.
I am capable of opening my own door, I said, getting out of the car. Why do today's women think it's important to open a door themselves? He said sharply. Do you believe it's a testament to your physical power?
No, but it is a sign of our independence. I stood with my arms crossed, daring him to contradict me, and remembering what Chris had said about Claremont's behavior toward a woman who'd asked too many questions at a conference. Wordlessly, he closed the car's door behind me and opened the cafe door. I stood resolutely in place, waiting for him to enter. A gust of warm, humid air carried the smell of bacon fat and toasted bread. My mouth started to water.
You're impossibly old-fashioned, I said with a sigh, deciding not to fight it.
He could open doors for me this morning, so long as he was prepared to buy me a hot breakfast.
Off to you, he murmured.
Once inside, we wended our way through the crowded tables. Claremont's skin, which had looked almost normal in the fog, was conspicuously pale under the cafe's stark overhead lighting. A couple of humans stared as we passed. The vampire stiffened. This wasn't a good idea, I thought uneasily as more human eyes studied us.
Hiya, Matthew,
a cheerful female voice called from behind the counter.
Two for breakfast?
His face lightened.
Two, Mary. How's Dan?
Well enough to complain that he's fed up being in bed. I'd say he's definitely on the mend.
That's wonderful news, Claremont said. Can you get this lady some tea when you have a chance? She's threatened to kill for it.
Won't be necessary, dearie, Mary told me with a smile. We serve tea without bloodshed.
She eased her ample body out from behind the formica counter and led us to a table tucked into the far corner next to the kitchen door. Two plastic-covered menus hit the table with a slap.
You'll be out of the way here, Matthew. I'll send Steph around with the tea. Stay as long as you like.
Claremont made a point of settling me with my back to the wall. He sat opposite, between me and the rest of the room, curling the laminated menu into a tube and letting it gently unfurl in his fingers, visibly bristling. In the presence of others, the vampire was restless and prickly, just as he had been in the library. He was much more comfortable when the two of us were alone. I recognized the significance of this behavior thanks to my new knowledge of the Norwegian wolf. He was protecting me.
Just who do you think poses a threat, Matthew? I told you I could take care of myself.
My voice came out a little more tartly than I had intended.
Yes, I'm sure you can, he said doubtfully.
Look, I said, trying to keep my tone even.
You've managed to keep them away from me so I could get some work done. The tables were too close together for me to include any more details. I'm grateful for that. But this cafe is full of humans. The only danger now would come from your drawing their attention. You're officially off duty.
Claremont cocked his head in the direction of the cash register.
That man over there told his friend that you looked tasty. He was trying to make light of it, but his face darkened.
I smothered a laugh.
I don't think he's going to bite me, I said.
The vampire's skin took on a grayish hue. From what I understand of modern British slang, tasty is a compliment, not a threat.
Claremont continued to glower. If you don't like what you're hearing, stop listening in on other people's conversations, I offered, impatient with his male posturing.
That's easier said than done, he pronounced, picking up a jar of Marmite.
A younger, slightly svelter version of Mary came up with an enormous brown stoneware teapot and two mugs. Milk and sugar are on the table, Matthew, she said, eyeing me with curiosity.
Matthew made the necessary introductions.
Steph, this is Diana. She's visiting from America.
Really? Do you live in California? I'm dying to get to California.
No, I live in Connecticut, I said regretfully.
That's one of the little states, isn't it?
Steph was clearly disappointed. Yes, and it snows.
I fancy palm trees and sunshine myself.
At the mention of snow, she'd lost interest in me entirely.
What'll it be?
I'm really hungry, I said apologetically, ordering 2 scrambled eggs, 4 pieces of toast, and several rashers of bacon. Steph, who had clearly heard far worse, wrote down the order without comment and picked up our menus.
Just tea for you, Matthew?
He nodded. Once Steph was out of earshot, I leaned across the table. Do they know about you?
Claremont tilted forward, his face a foot away from mine. This morning he smelled sweeter, like a freshly picked carnation. I inhaled deeply.
They know I'm a little different. Mary may suspect I'm more than a little different, but she's convinced that I saved Dan's life, so she's decided it doesn't matter.
How did you save her husband?
Vampires were supposed to take human lives, not save them.
I saw him on a rotation at the Ratcliffe when they were short-staffed.
Mary had seen a program that described the symptoms of stroke, and she recognized them when her husband began to struggle. Without her, he'd be dead or seriously incapacitated.
But she thinks you saved Dan?
The vampire's spiciness was making me dizzy. I lifted the lid from the teapot, replacing the aroma of carnations with the tannic smell of black tea.
Mary saved him the first time, but after he was admitted into hospital, he had a terrible reaction to his medication. I told you she's observant. When she took her concerns to one of the physicians, he brushed them aside. I overheard and intervened.
Do you often see patients?
I poured each of us a steaming mug of tea so strong you could stand a spoon up in it. My hands trembled slightly at the idea of a vampire prowling the wards at the John Radcliffe, among the sick and injured.
No, he said, toying with the sugar jar. Only when they have an emergency.
Pushing one of the mugs toward him, I fixed my eyes on the sugar. He handed it to me. I put precisely 1/2 a teaspoon of sugar and 1/2 a cup of milk into my tea. This was just how I liked it. Black as tar, a hint of sugar to cut the edge off the bitterness, then enough milk to make it look less like stew. This done, I stirred the concoction clockwise. As soon as experience told me it wouldn't burn my tongue, I took a sip.
Perfect. The vampire was smiling.
What? I asked.
I've never seen anyone approach tea with that much attentiveness to detail.
You must not spend much time with serious tea drinkers. It's all about being able to gauge the strength before you put the sugar and milk in it.
His steaming mug sat untouched in front of him.
You like yours black, I see.
Tea's not really my drink, he said, his voice dropping slightly.
What is your drink?
The minute the question was out of my mouth, I wished I could call it back. His mood went from amusement to tight-lipped fury.
You have to ask, he said scathingly. Even humans know the answer to that question.
I'm sorry, I shouldn't have. I gripped the mug, trying to steady myself.
No, you shouldn't.
I drank my tea in silence. We both looked up when Steph approached with a toast rack full of grilled bread and a plate heaped high with eggs.